Welcome to our latest podcast. Today I'm interviewing Jonathan Nelson, the founder and CEO of Hackers Founders, the largest network of tech founders in Silicon Valley and around the world. He is also the managing director at the Hack Fund and has served on the board of advisors for the SEC's capital formation for small and emerging businesses. He's also lectured at UC Berkeley and Stanford. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Great. Why don't we start out by having you tell us what Hackers Founders is?
So Hackers and Founders is a bit of a strange organization. It really started off about a decade ago when I moved to Silicon Valley, and I was just trying to build my own business network. And so I started an event called Hackers and Founders, and that event just kept on growing and growing and growing. And within a couple of years, we started seeing a lot of companies trying to come to Silicon Valley to raise money from around the world. This was 2009, 2010. And we ended up, there really weren't a whole lot of resources for people trying to come to Silicon Valley from the outside. And it's hard to raise money unless you're kind of really connected into this network. And so we started kind of a soft landing program for companies. And so we've worked with 55 companies the last 5 years. We have been services for equity. So startups pay us a bit of stock in their company. We help the companies with banking, legal, restructuring the company, fundraising, business development. We see ourselves as investors in these companies. So we invest a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. People work out of our offices for as long as they need to or want to. And we worked about 55 companies. Those companies have raised a bit over $100 million. We've had 8 acquisitions from our portfolio. One of the challenges that we have had has been we take payment in stock, but stock doesn't pay my rent. So we've built a series of little mini mutual funds, where we bundle the startup stock that we get from the startups, and then we sell roughly half of the bundle. A quarter of the bundle goes back to the entrepreneurs themselves. So it's kind of a shared ownership model, and we'll keep about a third of the bundle. So we call it our founders cooperative because everybody's sitting at this, everybody eats out of the same pie. It's the entrepreneurs, us, our investors. And so that's kind of the Hackers and Founders co-op. Program. Hackers and Founders events went viral in 2009, 2010. Those have now been held in, I believe, 140 cities around the world. Over 300,000 entrepreneurs have attended Hackers and Founders events.
Wow.
That has been, by and large, just word of mouth, people wanting to kind of get together with other Hackers and Founders. And it's been because of that we've tried to, that we've kind of had to innovate in solving kind of these community problems that we actually have. And that's what led me to join the SEC advisory committee and get involved in crowdfunding and that sort of stuff. Because I think a lot of the ways in which we raise money in Silicon Valley breaks. I think it kind of works here in Silicon Valley, but I think it breaks in pretty much everywhere else in the world.
Well, why do you think so much money is invested in Silicon Valley as opposed to other areas?
So we actually did a root cause analysis of this when I was working at the SEC Advisory Committee, when I was volunteering there. And it all boils down to liquidity. What do I mean by that? How the mechanics of how we invest in companies are this. I'm going to invest in your podcast. So I'm going to buy stock in your podcast company. And I've given you money in exchange for that stock. But where do I as an investor go to sell that stock again? My money is frozen inside of your company. There's really two ways right now where I can sell that stock again. One is when you sell your podcasting company to the Google, the Facebook, the whoever, and that company buys all of your stock and all of my stock and the stock of the other investors, and we all get rich together.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you get large enough, you can have an IPO, and then I can sell my stock on the NASDAQ. But that takes about a 10 to 15 year process, and you have to be doing $100 million in revenue on your podcast business for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it boils down to it, it's this liquidity problem. Now, one of the main ways that investors make money, especially angel investors, is when the companies get acquired. And 85% of the world's mergers and acquisitions in the world of technology happen in Silicon Valley. So that's why two-thirds, three-quarters of the world's angel and venture capital gets invested in Silicon Valley. Is here's where you have the closed loop. You have a full ecosystem where investors can get liquidity. They can resell that stock to a big company. They can resell the stock on an IPO and that sort of stuff.
Okay. Well, I assume there's lots of ways for startups to raise money, and maybe you can go into just a little bit of detail on the various ways for someone who's starting a startup to raise capital.
Yep. So I know of five ways, maybe six is emerging, to actually get money for your company. And I do not recommend all of them. One of them is if you really, really want to, you could steal money for your company. I do not recommend that. That is a bad idea. Two is you can borrow money. You can rack up credit cards. You can borrow money from friends and family and repay them as a loan. It's also very difficult when you're just starting off a business to take on debt, because you never know how well the business is going to go, how much revenue you're going to have in the future. So that's kind of a high-risk proposition. Another one is a lot of countries have government grants and government programs to support startups. I'm thinking about Startup Chile. I've been an advisor to that program for years. You get a $40K to $100K government grant to come and work out of Chile for a year for your startup.
Wow.
There is selling stock, which is selling part of your company to investors. And that's kind of typical angel investors. That's venture capital. That's what they think. And the last way that I think startups can actually raise money for their company is by revenue. I said the R word. You can actually sell a product and grow revenue. And I'm actually a big fan of revenue. And most of the other investors in Silicon Valley are requiring some pretty exorbitant revenue numbers before you can actually raise money from them. But revenue is, I think, the main point of having a business is to sell things.
Mm-hmm.
And so, selling your stock, how do you do that? Well, I can sell stock to angels or rich people. I can sell stock to venture capitalists who they invest other rich people's money. And crowdfunding is something that we worked on the SEC Advisory Committee for a couple of years, which is you can sell stock if you meet certain regulatory requirements to pretty much anyone. Within certain limits.
And that used to be restricted to just accredited investors, and now it's kind of open to everyone?
Yeah, it's so if you want to kind of geek out, the history of how we sell stock in the United States, I find it fascinating, but then I'm a nerd. So in the 1930s, we were having a big problem with people having stock selling scams. And it was really hard to get decent information on a company. And so you'd have these, shysters going out and selling stock into a company, and there wasn't a company there. And so enough people lost money that the government passed a couple of laws to regulate how this stock was sold, bought and sold. And they essentially said in 1933 that only rich people, accredited investors, can invest in startups, or invest in private companies. More or less, you have to be a millionaire. The government kind of says, if you're a millionaire, you can kind of do whatever you want with your money.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not a millionaire, you're not really smart enough to make smart investment decisions, or you're not wealthy enough to be able to take that kind of risk, and so we're going to prevent you from making those kind of investment decisions. And really, the thing that everybody gets terrified about inside of the SEC and the government is little old ladies losing their retirement pension,
mm-hmm.
Because they invested in a scam. And so those are the rules to do that. Now, fast forward 70-some-odd years, the Obama administration passed the Jobs Act, which said, okay, you know what? If you have a small business, we're going to let you sell stock to anyone, even people who are not accredited investors, who are not millionaires, but you got to do a couple of things. You have to disclose your reviewed financials. I don't have any revenue. Here's what the accountant said. Or I do have revenue. Here's what the accountant said. And then you can actually sell to up to an individual non-rich person can buy up to $2,500 worth of stock in a company or up to 10% of their annual income, whichever is greater. And depending on how much information, how much regulatory approval you want to go through, there's a couple of different categories. One, you can raise up to $1 million with very light kind of, you know, these are my financials. Mm-hmm. You can raise up to $5 million within certain limits, and you have to disclose certain financials. That's Reg A. And then Reg A Plus, it's kind of like a mini IPO. You do have to get approved by the SEC. You have to file audited financials for 2 years. But if you do that, then you can actually sell up to $50 million a year worth of your stock in your company. Wow. And so that's been a pretty huge change. The problem is where do your investors sell their stock a second time? You know, they need that company to be acquired or need that company to IPO on a stock exchange. Mm-hmm. And those are still really, really large hurdles. And so that's why I think things are kind of broken for a lot of entrepreneurs. And that's why I don't think equity crowdfunding or selling stock online has really taken off. And frankly, I think that's one of the reasons why this whole blockchain and this whole cryptocurrency thing has taken off, is a lot of people are using that as an alternative way to raise money.
Hmm. Well, why don't we talk about that a little bit? How would a global stock exchange work for global startups?
So essentially, what's been happening is a really easy use case for this new blockchain technology is you sell a little digital widget, a token, or something, and I can sell that to anybody online in exchange for cash, or I can sell it to someone online in exchange for Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. What a lot of companies are doing is they are creating these digital tokens. They are promising that they are going to do X, Y, and Z. If, you know, with the money that they raise from these tokens, from the sale of these digital tokens. And then afterwards, people can take those digital tokens and go onto one of thousands of digital, you know, crypto exchanges, and they can buy, sell, and trade, you know, your podcast token. If that's what you wanted to do, if you wanted to have your token sale, you could issue, you know, 100 million pod tokens or podcast tokens for 10 cents a piece. People bought them, and then afterwards they could buy, sell, and trade them for 10 cents a piece or whatever price it is, however the market sees based on what your price is floating and that sort of stuff on the exchanges. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. But as long as we're talking about tokens and cryptocurrency, there's been kind of a big collapse recently. Do you think that's going to affect the use of tokens to raise money? Or maybe I should ask, maybe a better question is, what do you think of the cryptocurrency market at this time?
So I am very long crypto and blockchain. What it does on any particular week or month or even year, I don't know. You know, I'm excited when it goes up because my friends make a lot of money. I'm sad when it goes down because my friends aren't making a whole lot of money. It's this weird new market, and I don't think anybody really has a good feel for why these things are happening. Part of it, I think, is this global nature. We've recently opened offices in China, and 40% of active cryptocurrency traders are Chinese.
Hmm.
And so, like, you don't necessarily hear that on Wall Street Business financial news. Uh-huh. Is you don't hear what's happening in the Korean markets, Korea, China, Japan, Vietnam, and the Philippines are actually kind of rising in terms of people who are buying and selling these cryptocurrencies. Uh-huh. But we don't really have a good insight into what's happening into the crypto markets there. And so there's just wide swings in prices, and no one really knows why. I'm very much a fan of asset-backed crypto. What do I mean by that? By, you know, for instance, your podcast token, if you were to sell that, you could promise a percentage of your future revenues to the token holders. You could essentially promise dividends. Mm-hmm. That would be an asset-backed token because it's backed by the revenues that your company would be generating. I'm doing a lot of work on building blockchain stock certificates, which would essentially be backed by the revenue of the company that issues them, much like kind of how we're describing this podcast token. And in fact, that is how my venture fund works. Is it has essentially digital stock certificates that people can buy online. Unfortunately, not if you're an accredited if you're an accredited investor in the United States, you can buy it. If you're unaccredited, you can't. I'm sorry, that's the law. Mm-hmm. But if you are not in the United States, you can essentially buy this token, and we will use that money to invest in, you know, 300 tech companies. And eventually my job is to make the value of those tech companies grow over the long term so that my token, my share, my digital stock grows in value over the long term. And then that stock will be traded online. Mm-hmm. That digital stock, because it's blockchain based, can be traded on these crypto exchanges.
I see. Do you think?
Go ahead.
I was going to say there's been a lot of volatility in the crypto market. Do you think there needs to be more stability for cryptocurrency to catch on? In other words, like the dollar, for example, doesn't fluctuate. I mean, it's been very strong, but it doesn't fluctuate like cryptos do. But maybe if there's more stability and less volatility, then it'll catch on as an alternative type of currency.
I'm, you know, a lot of people are actually using it as a currency, but they're using it for like specific use cases. Mm-hmm. For instance, I do a lot of international wire transfers. And my use case for cryptocurrency is I would much rather send, you know, $20,000 worth of Ethereum from my wallet to another investor's wallet that they can cash right away into Mexican pesos or euros or whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm using that as a means of transfer of value, much rather than having to pay banks, you know, $50 or $100 to issue the wire transfer, to call, to get it approved, to do this and that and the other thing, and to wait 3 days and call the bank, hey, did the wire go through, this and that and the other thing. The user experience around wire transfers is terrible. And even though transferring crypto from one person to another, it's still a very poor user experience. It's much better than wire transfers. So international commerce, I think a lot of people are starting to use it now. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's a lot of volatility in this market. I don't know. I think that's kind of a feature and not necessarily a bug. I mean, it is what it is.
Yes.
It's still a very small market. The market cap is only $200 billion. That's, you know, what 20% of what Apple is worth. Mm-hmm. And so once you start to get into a market cap of trillions of dollars worth of crypto, tens of trillions of dollars, and I believe that it eventually will get there, I think you'll see a lot more price stability over the long term for these crypto assets, because it will take a lot more money moving in the system to actually move the prices one way or another. Right now, if you bought, you know, $1 million, $5 million worth of Bitcoin, my guess is you would probably see the price move significantly. Mm-hmm. Just because the market cap is actually so low.
I see. Okay. I mean, do you think, I know you can't predict, but do you think this is just a temporary drop in the in the crypto market, you know, with Bitcoin, I haven't even checked it today, but, you know, it's, and Ethereum, I know, has taken a big drop. Yep. Do you think this is just a temporary thing, and it's just a matter of waiting it out over the next year, and we'll see?
You know, I think what's happened is there's been a lot of shakeout. There's been a lot of kind of regulatory confusion, which I think is actually getting a lot more clear. Mm-hmm. A lot of tokens issued in the United States are securities. Most of them are. Mm-hmm. If people are buying it to make a profit, the SEC defines that as a security. Mm-hmm. So you have to follow existing crowdfunding laws. Uh-huh. I think a lot of companies are starting to realize that in the United States, they're starting to slow down. The vast majority of this market is not based in the United States. It's very global. It's very international. And yeah, I think eventually, you know, the dollar is stable. The Venezuelan Bolivar, the Mexican peso, or, you know, the Argentinian peso, the Mexican peso, maybe not so much. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're holding the Turkish lira, you probably wanted to actually, you much rather have held Bitcoin than the Turkish lira this last week. Mm-hmm. Even with the volatility, you know, it was still probably a better asset to actually own and diversify into. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing a lot of other people in other countries start to use it as a way to kind of decrease their own currency risk. And it's an asset that they can actually purchase online. And many people around the world cannot purchase decent investment products. They don't have like an E-Trade or a Schwab account where they can day trade. You actually have to call a broker in many countries and still make your purchase order that way. It's very, very kind of old school. And I think a lot of people around the world increasingly are going to start using crypto as an asset class that they can actually invest in. And eventually you'll see the large institutions come in. You just saw a piece by Yale, a professor at Yale, come out saying that it should be anywhere between 0.5 to 6% of your portfolio, depending on your risk profile. But he thinks that crypto and digital assets are an asset class that you should actually own a little bit of to fully diversify your portfolio. Mm-hmm. Which was fascinating, you know.
Yeah.
Dude at Yale, which is a very well-respected institution, is starting to publish this stuff. And my guess is a lot of institutional investors will start to perk up and say, hey, how do I do that?
Yeah. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about the startup landscape.
Yep.
Where do you see the startup situation going, like, say, during the next 5 years? Are we going to continue to see the startup growth that we've seen over the last several years? Are we going to kind of taper off? Or are we going to slow down?
What I've seen in Hackers and Founders is this global explosion of tech entrepreneurship. If I can afford a $200 laptop and an internet connection, I can code, I can build an app, I can launch a web app, I can build, you know, my own blockchain. I can build a technology product that I can sell through the internet to the entire world. And so I'm increasingly seeing a lot more entrepreneurs in emerging markets who can now afford to build technologies. And what's really has me excited is the problems these entrepreneurs are solving aren't necessarily problems that you see in Silicon Valley. You know, I was just talking with before this podcast, I just finished giving a talk to a group of Paraguayan entrepreneurs who are visiting Silicon Valley. Huh. You know, 100% of people in Paraguay or 110% of people in Paraguay have cell phones with a data plan. Very good cellular mobile penetration. Mm-hmm. 35% of the population have a bank account. Huh. 10% of the population have a credit card. There's a huge gap there that I think is a business opportunity for mobile banking services, mm-hmm. Mobile payments, that sort of thing. You're not going to see that. That's not a first world problem. That's a second or third world problem. And so that's what's exciting to me. And yes, I think that you're still going to have this innovation churn, this, you know, huge engine in Silicon Valley and these other big startup hubs. I think what you're going to see in the next five years is a lot of other startup hubs starting to pop up around the globe. As capital, as people can actually raise capital online, as people can have access to more capital where they're at, they'll actually build the companies where they're at instead of making the pilgrimage to, you know, Silicon Valley Mecca, you know, walking around the Google campus seven times and, you know, facing towards Facebook and praying, you know, oh, VCs, please give me money. These entrepreneurs are actually staying where they're at. They can start to raise capital where they're at, access crypto capital markets instead of just traditional venture capital markets. I think you're going to see a lot more. You're going to see a huge explosion of technology companies from around the world, in addition to the normal innovation that you see in Silicon Valley. That's kind of my vision of the future over the next 5 to 10 years.
So it sounds like the big growth will be outside the U.S., in maybe second and third world countries.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see tech in Silicon Valley slowing down at all. Okay. I mean, you have huge, massive companies. You know, I live in San Jose, and Google just bought a number of square blocks of underutilized real estate in downtown San Jose, and they are going to, you know, build offices for 50,000 employees. And, you know, Apple just, you know, bought a large parcel of land in San Jose as well, and they want to build a building to house three times as many employees, two or three times as many employees as the spaceship in Cupertino. Hmm. I don't see that slowing down at all.
Plus, you know, they have plenty of cash also.
Oh, yeah, they got money to burn. Yeah. And so these people are investing, they're acquiring technologies, you know, they're interested in growing those acquisitions, end up giving more money to the angel investors and venture capitalists, which keep on investing in the next generation of startups. I still see that continuing. I don't see a whole lot of bubble or froth in the Silicon Valley market. I see a lot of, you know, it's almost impossible to have a pitch deck and to raise $1 million. Like, you can't raise money on an idea anymore in Silicon Valley. You pretty much have to have, you know, $5,000 to $10,000 in monthly recurring revenue to raise from a seed fund in Silicon Valley, which is kind of ridiculous, I think. But that is what it is.
Do you think the government's not crackdown, but concerns about Facebook and Twitter and some of the other major tech companies will have any effect at all on that area of startups? In other words, the social networking, social media type startups.
I hope so. You know, I'm kind of a privacy nut. And so I purposefully really have not used Facebook. I choose to use LinkedIn, and that's a marketing vehicle. I'm very conscious and deliberate about how I use that. But I have been very concerned about privacy for years, and now the rest of the world is kind of saying, hey, maybe we don't want to share all of our life online. Maybe, you know, really hyper-targeted advertising to poor African-American voters in rural Michigan or in Michigan is not a great thing when it comes to elections, you know. Or maybe we need to develop some regulation around this. I really expect a lot of Europe and the European Union, where privacy is seen as a fundamental human right, there is going to be a massive kind of technology war between major Silicon Valley players and the European Union, because it's a huge market. These companies want to be there, but they're going to have to do some pretty strict compliance with EU regulations. And I think that is going to have a chilling effect on new social companies. A lot of the companies that I'm seeing come out now have a bit of hardware that they're selling. They're B2B SaaS companies. They're actually selling revenue and focused on revenue. I don't see a whole lot of socially commercial customer facing technologies that are really booming right now.
It almost sounds like the growth will be in the privacy type either software or some sort of software systems where, you know, it'll actually check your privacy online or control it if you do want to continue to use some of these social networking sites. Anyway, it's just a thought that popped in my head as a as a market.
No, absolutely. Part of the problem is, you know, when you use a product online and it's free, you are actually paying for that product with your privacy. Mm-hmm. You and your personal data are the product that is being bundled and sold to advertisers. So the price for using these apps is my privacy. And I suspect people are going to start to say, I don't want to pay that price or it's too expensive. Or I sign a privacy policy now, and then in 2 years you change your privacy policy, and that's not what I agreed to, but I'm still using your platform, so that's what I have to abide by. So my privacy cost went up. Uh-huh. I gave away a lot more privacy than I was bargaining. And I suspect we're going to start to see some regulation around that. And I suspect, you know, there's going to be a giant tug of war between, you know, big tech and Washington, D.C., especially as this has come out about the elections and that sort of stuff, and Cambridge Analytica. But it'll be fun to watch. But, you know, these companies are still cash cows. Mm-hmm. You know, Google makes, what, $50, $60 billion a year in profit. Uh-huh. Revenue, I don't know what the latest numbers are, but it's something, you know, these are fantastic cash cows, and they can afford to pay a $5 billion fine and really not sneeze. Uh-huh. That's one quarter's profit, you know?
Yeah.
So.
All right. We're getting close to the end. Why don't we wrap up with one final question. If you had to give three pieces of advice to someone who's creating a startup for the first time, what would it be?
Three pieces of advice. Talk to your customer. Don't imagine your customer. Talk to your customer. Like my first four companies, I had imaginary customers that I was building products for. And obviously those failed. And I spent a lot of time imagining what an amazing startup I could build and this and that and the other thing and building a product for this imaginary startup, imaginary customer. And I just failed miserably. And it wasn't until I started having conversations with thousands of entrepreneurs that I started to say, hey, maybe there's a bit of a business here helping to solve these entrepreneurs' problems. Mm-hmm. You know, if I can help a company move to Silicon Valley, if I can help them raise money, get settled, if I can help them with immigration visas, that sort of stuff, like that's a good business. And it's been a fantastic business for us. But it's been, it was my customers beating me over the head with their problems where I finally started to realize what was happening. And so, you know, if you're building a startup, get away from the computer, get out of the house, go talk to your customers, find out what annoys them, what frustrates them, what angers them, you know, ask businesses what problems they have making money and say, hey, if I solve this problem for you, will you give me a little bit of money? Like, that's a fantastic way to actually start a startup. Mm-hmm. And you don't even have to write software or build anything to have those conversations. So, you know, talk to people. I know we tend to be kind of pretty geeky building tech companies, but you really do have to, you know, be in this position of talking to people, finding out what their needs are, and then building a technology product to solve that, as opposed to just imagining them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great answer, and I really appreciate you doing this this podcast. Thanks very much.
My pleasure. It was a delight. I'm really happy to be here, and thanks for the opportunity.